I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Public space is important in both cities and in buildings. We'll talk to two people today who are attempting to reimagine those public spaces, both inside and out. Anthony Wood is the executive director of the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. He studies and reports on all aspects of the planning, design, and construction of tall buildings. He'll tell us about the revolution that's needed in tall buildings to transform them into livable structures for the 21st century. And we'll speak with David Dixon. David is the principal of planning and urban design with Goody Clancy and Associates, and we'll talk about his amazing urban design work in New Orleans and Miami, and what he's learned about Muslim principles of design when he took his ideas to Pakistan for a project in Karachi. All this plus the latest news from PlanetiZen's Nate Berg on today's Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Anthony Wood is the executive director of the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. The council is based at the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago and studies tall buildings and sustainable urban environments, and then spreads its knowledge to architects, city planners, and engineers in an effort to create the next generation of tall buildings. Tell me today, what is the tallest building in the world?
The tallest building completed and occupied in the world is Taipei 101 in Taiwan. The next tallest building is Burj Dubai, which is almost complete, but we would not class it as the tallest building in the world till it's complete, clad, and occupied.
And what is the trend today in tall buildings? Are we building more of them, and where are we building them?
We're building more of them, and they're higher than they've ever been. So I think just last year, there are now more tall buildings in Asia than there are in North America. So, and yet we've seen a resurgence of tall buildings in North America. So for the first time, probably in the history of mankind, in the last 10 years, we have seen tall buildings built across every continent. And if you'd looked at the world's tallest building perhaps 20, 30 years ago, you'd have predicted three things with some confidence. One, that it would be in North America. Two, that it would be an office building. And three, it would be built of steel construction. And now, virtually the exact opposite is true. The world's tallest buildings, super tall buildings, are being proposed predominantly in Asia or the Middle East. They're predominantly residential construction, and they're concrete or composite concrete and steel structure. So it's been a complete inverse of where we were perhaps 20 or 30 years ago.
Why do people want to live in buildings that are tall?
Well, I think it's two things. I think one, first of all, it's driven because of land prices and the density of cities. So these tall buildings are built, and someone very famous said, build it and they will come. So in a lot of cases, I think it's just the pattern of living, especially in a lot of North American cities. However, of course, there are a lot of people who choose to live in tall buildings. And I think that's because of two things, really. I think it's because of the access to what they perceive as a better environment. And by a better environment, I mean view, light, away from the maddening crowd. But I think it's also because of the proximity to facilities. You don't get tall buildings, you know, out in the suburbs. And so a tall building usually comes hand in hand with being close to restaurants and theatre, opera. I mean, interestingly, just to pick up on that, there are two types of people that live in tall buildings, though. There are those that can afford to and choose to, and there are those that can't afford to and don't choose to, and those are completely different things within the same typology.
And that's hard to understand, because on the one hand, tall buildings have been accused of being the problem with subsidized housing, and yet, as you say, people with more money, the highest income demographic, are choosing to live in tall buildings. So what was the problem with tall buildings in a subsidized situation?
Well, I think there are a lot of problems, but first and foremost, these buildings were not designed with the necessary infrastructure in place to accommodate the people that were going in there. And by infrastructure, I don't necessarily mean technical infrastructure, you know, lifts that work and lights that work and those things, though those things are obviously essential. They were not designed with the quality of finishes to make people at home. And they weren't designed with communal space. These cities got higher and taller, but the things that make up a city weren't put into the buildings, which I think are essential. Communal space, predominantly. The opportunity for neighbourhood and community to develop, which anybody really needs, irrespective of whether they live tall or small. So, and the other thing is, if you look at the demographics of a lot of people who do occupy tall buildings at the higher end, a large part of these people that have been populating this resurgence of inner city living in North American cities and other cities are actually the empty nesters. They're the people whose families have left, and they want to be back in the city. They don't need a 5-bedroom home anymore, and these people naturally have perhaps a higher aggregate money savings than other people. So I think tall buildings can evolve to be appropriate for all factors of society, but absolutely up to this point in time they haven't been.
I think it's interesting you're executive director of something called the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. What led you to this, and what does the council do?
Well, the council is the world's leading body in the field of tall buildings. We were set up 40 years ago in 1969. Next year we'll be celebrating our 40th anniversary. And we were set up very much with one mission. We were set up by a guy called Lynn Beadle, and very important architects and engineers working at Skidmore, Owings, Merrill, who at that time were designing and building the Hancock Tower and the Sears Tower. These were the world's tallest buildings. You know, basically they said, hey, we're doing stuff that has never been done before, and we need to disseminate this information around the world. And they did, and they set up the council to do that. 40 years later, that is still our primary mission, to disseminate information on tall buildings around the world. Though, of course, our scope and our international spread and all these things has increased massively, because tall buildings have increased massively since 1969, you know, to almost all continents.
You said that one of the trends at work in tall buildings is mixed use, not simply tall buildings for office uses, but now for mixed use. What's driving that?
I think, again, there are a number of factors that are driving it, but one is I think a lot of developers want to edge their bets. So it doesn't make sense to build an all office tower speculatively if you're not sure. Well, you've got to remember with a tall building, any tall building is at least 5-6 years to fruition. From the initial thought of it to actually being occupied, it's a long time. So you're asking developers and people that are putting money up to predict where the market's going to be 6 years down the line, 5 years down the line. It's different if you have a corporation who come and say, I want a headquarters building. Then, you can proceed in more confidence with an office building. But if you're doing this speculatively, one of the main drivers is that there's a tendency for developers to edge their bets. Put in residential and office, usually one market might not decline when another is, put in other functions. But it's also about more than that. I think a lot of people are quite genuinely trying to create interesting mixes in the building. There's interesting things that can happen when you have office and residential occupancy together in a building. You know, for example, car parking spaces can be shared, because residential is predominantly occupied at times when office isn't. So there's energy savings to be had between, heating and cooling, various others. So there's a lot of benefits towards mixed-use buildings.
You mentioned energy savings. Are tall buildings sustainable?
Well, it depends on what scale you look. A lot of people believe that tall buildings are anti-sustainable because of the energy it takes to create them in the first place and then to run them. The embodied energy in the materials and getting those up at height, the energy that goes into the elevators to get people up and down, the lighting and all these factors. And people do believe that tall buildings are anti-environmental and certainly super tall over a threshold. Now, whilst I would agree that super tall buildings over a certain threshold, and no one can say what that threshold is because it depends on place, because it varies from place to place. But although I think that super tall buildings are perhaps not as sustainable, they're being driven by other things. They're being driven by iconicness and corporate ego, perhaps, and various other things. But tall buildings, I do firmly believe, are sustainable in the bigger picture issues. And the bigger picture issues are about creating denser, more concentrated cities and patterns of life. We can no longer continue to develop our cities amongst the American model of a dense downtown working core and an ever-expanding suburb where everybody lives on a big plot of land in a freestanding house. And we reduce green belt, and we have to put in the infrastructure, and people commute 2 hours by car with the pollutants from that and the energy expenditure. We just cannot carry on that way. We've got to find denser patterns, denser ways to live. And this is especially relevant in countries like China and India. I mean, no one's saying in America we've got to pack up the suburb and put everyone back in the city. That's not going to happen. But what you've got to remember that in places like China and India, we're seeing a predominantly rural population migrating to urban at an alarming rate. I think China needs the equivalent of a Chicago, every year for the next 20 years to cope with its population. Something incredible like that. Where do these people go? If they follow the American model of the city and suburb model, then, you know, to be honest, we're all in a mess because of the impact on the environment for that. But it also has a relevant back in countries like ours, like America and the UK, because changing social demographics are requiring a massive increase in housing, increased immigration, but also changing social demographics. And what I mean by that, people are living longer. Divorce rate is up. There are more single people households. So where do these households go? In the southeast of England, we need 200,000 new homes every year for the next 10 years to cope with housing everybody. Where do those homes go? And although tall buildings are not the only solution, there are ways to achieve density without tall buildings. They've got to become part of the solution, denser, more compact cities.
It does seem interesting to me that below a certain income level, tall buildings or density seems to be a negative. It carries negative connotations. Why do you think that is, and how do we change that?
I touched on some of the reasons before. It's because people, A, they had no choice. What you've got to remember is a lot of people that were put in high-rise buildings, it's the same in my country. You know, it's the same in large parts of Europe. It was based on this post-war ideal, the Le Corbusian ideal, the unit de habitation of putting people up in the sky where the environment's better. But what you've got to remember is you've taken these people from often closely connected neighborhoods where they know people all around them. It's a social infrastructure. And you've completely severed that by putting them up in the air, putting them in high-rise apartments where there's no sense of space for community to develop or even to be fostered. So you would only see your neighbors, you know, perhaps as you're going in and out of your apartment. There's no space. And then you come down to the ground plane, which would often be neglected, deserted. And then because this was for the poorer parts of society or not so well-off parts of society, the buildings were never maintained. They were badly designed to begin with, and they were never maintained. The money wasn't put in to make sure the lifts worked and the paint was repainted every few years and the kids' playground at the base was re-landscaped and all those things. So it was an ever-increasing spiral of despair and neglect. We can see many people live successfully in tall buildings, at the richer echelons of society. So what's the reality? Do they work or do they don't work? And the reality is they can work if they're designed correctly and the infrastructure is put in place to make them work. And infrastructure, I'm talking human infrastructure rather than technical, although that's important. I'm talking space, green materials and functions that we rely on.
Would you agree, though, that accepting poor people who were disconnected from their existing neighborhoods and put into towers in subsidized housing, and wealthy people who have long gravitated to tall buildings. There's a middle class that believes one needs a backyard to raise children properly. And again, density is a bad thing, inherently a bad thing. So do you see tall buildings as a viable option for people who perhaps are in the middle class, or will they continue to use the settlement patterns that they have for the last 50 years?
Well, this is the point. When I say that tall buildings need to evolve to become something that they're not yet, I'm talking a major revolution. I'm not talking about slightly wider corridors so your kid can cycle his tricycle down there. I'm talking about if it requires government investment, then government investment as well as, you know, private industry to create tall buildings that are suitable. And so, for example, there's one of the best buildings built is a building called the Commerzbank in Frankfurt in Germany. And one of the reasons that this built, it's an office building for the Commerzbank. One of the reasons this is an incredible building is because about half of the potential floor space in the building is given over to gardens that spiral up the tower, and huge gardens that might take up 4 or 5 stories. And this is done to give a space for the office workers to have their lunch in. It's used for meetings rooms. These gardens are semi-enclosed, so sometimes they're open to the outside air, sometimes they're closed, and sitting within huge atria. And I believe that this is a fantastic model for a residential building. That's what I'm talking about. These gardens, significant spaces, which not only improve the aesthetics of the building, but give the chance for community to develop. It doesn't have to be a totally utopian thing. One of these gardens might be linked to a kindergarten or a school, which exists on that level. Another might be linked to a restaurant, which operates at night, but during the day, the inhabitants of the building. Now, I live out in a house in Oak Park. I'm the director of the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, but I live in a detached house. Why do I do that? Because I've got 2 children, 2 and 5, and I want my kids to have a yard to play in. But in today's world, Would I rather my kids to play in the front yard where who knows what might happen? You know, they might run out into the road, they might get snatched, they might be, or could they be playing together with other children in a more secure environment away from traffic, you know, with the other inhabitants of the tower? I don't have that choice because there are no buildings that kind of do it. But what needs to happen is that governments need to start investing in buildings in the same way they invest in cities. Parks and roads and lights and streets are seen as the government's responsibility. What I'm saying is when those are put into tall buildings, they should also be partly government responsibility. It's not just a case of responsibility absolved at the ground plane. That's you, Mr. Private Developer. Get on with it. In a few cases around the world, it's been proven to work. I give you an office example. There are other residential examples. What we need to do is not so much concentrate on the buildings, but concentrate on the conditions that have allowed those buildings, which do provide successfully for all its inhabitants, to flourish. We need to look at what the conditions were, economic conditions, political decisions, social decisions, situation, and recreate that rather than get hankered up with looking at a single building. In other words, it's bigger picture stuff.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Anthony Wood of the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitats. As we began talking about the future of tall buildings, Anthony refers to the presidential election as upcoming. We recorded our interview the weekend before Election Day, so while we didn't know who the next president would be when we recorded our interview, that should all be decided by the time you hear this. You've been working on tall buildings that are far more sustainable. What are some of the techniques or the strategies that you've been working with, that you've been playing with even, that would make tall buildings significantly more sustainable?
Well, first of all, you've got to get the fundamentals right. Everybody has agreed on this. Part of the problem with sustainability has been hijacked. You know, everybody is green in inverted commas, and it's been hijacked and it's helping nobody because there is no regulation on, first of all, what constitutes sustainability. There's no standard of saying this is sustainability, do you meet it or not? It's starting to happen, but it's not happened yet. So sustainability has become hijacked. And a lot of the time, so-called sustainable buildings and sustainable tall buildings are actually quite the opposite. And what happens is one or two high-profile experimental typologies are applied to the building and they're classed as an environmental tower because they might have a wind turbine on the top or they might have a photovoltaic array down one side. It's nonsense. If you want to create a true environmental tower, you've got to get the basics right. And the basics are about the orientation of the building relative to sun and wind. They're about where you place the lift core relative to the floor space. They're about what you build the building out of in terms of skin. Do you go for all glass towers or introduce some opacity and thermal mass into the building? These are the fundamentals, and you've got to get the fundamentals right before that you then think, okay, well, I've done the best I can do there. Now do I start to create some of the energy I'm going to use back through harnessing wind or solar or water or these other things? And so at IIT, at the Illinois Institute of Technology, where I'm a professor, where the council is based, we've done a lot of work with the students there where we're exploring what the next generation of tall sustainable towers could become, how to harness wind farms in tall buildings, how to grow vegetable produce in tall buildings, because it's nonsensical to have imported and exported food traveling all around the world. You need to create food at the source where you're going to eat it. And so we've done projects into tall greenhouses. We've done solar thermal projects, which look to harness solar energy in a concentrated way and store that in thermal. We've also done projects that challenge the traditional functions of tall buildings, which are predominantly office, residential, and hotel. We're advocating that we need, again, back to the idea of communal urban space, we need more of the city functions to come up a tall building. And perhaps the biggest thing for me is that we need to start to introduce connections between buildings. And when I say connections, I mean sky bridges. It seems silly that we're going for taller, denser cities, and yet the sidewalk remains the sole plane of physical connection. We need to start connecting the tall buildings. And in connecting, it has a lot of benefits. It has benefits in terms of fire evacuation, being able to get out of a tall building to buildings adjoining. It has circulatory benefits. You can, you know, circulate across and get this wonderful view down on the city. It has an impact on the dynamics of the functions inside the building, because suddenly you're getting people coming in halfway up the tower, for example, where you can recreate the public realm. And in the past, when sky bridges have been proposed, the critics of sky bridges have always opposed them on the grounds of that they neglect the public realm. If you do this, then the public realm will be neglected. But I don't see this being the case. If you are going to concentrate twice as many people on the same plot of land in taller, denser cities, then there is a requirement for twice more restaurants, twice more parks, twice more kindergarten, twice more schools. And what I'm saying is we need to recreate the ground plane at a higher level, not at the expense of the ground plane, but in addition.
Well, I think, though, that when you see how the sky bridges pioneered in Minneapolis and then spread to other cities that were, in fact, not dense, you've got some problems on the street. It did remove life from the street. But I understand in really dense, really tall buildings, it makes a lot of sense. Let me ask you one other question, and that is, what do you see as the future aesthetics of tall buildings?
Well, that's my $60 million passionate question, because all this that I've spoken about already, what disappoints me more is that I don't think the aesthetics of tall buildings have moved on much in the last 50, 60 years. We're still building all glass and steel modernist towers, the same kind of architecture that Mies van der Rohe and others were building 50, 60 years ago. And we need to acknowledge that we're in the middle of a major challenge. Well, we're at the start of a major challenge in terms of climate change and developing more sustainable cities, not just tall buildings, more sustainable cities. This should be seen as an opportunity, not a threat. It should be seen as an opportunity politically. It should be seen as an opportunity economically. This is what a lot of our leaders are saying, but the public's not kind of seeing that. You know, the election, you know, this. I heard Bill Clinton speak earlier this year, and he said this is the greatest chance we've had to mobilize around a common thing that needs doing and reinvigorate our economy since World War II. And there's an opportunity for all these things to lead us out of the economic crisis, new jobs, all the rest of it. There is an opportunity for tall buildings to reinvent themselves. It is totally nonsensical for these tall buildings to still have the same appearance and aesthetics that they have for the past 50 years. We need to stop building all glass and steel towers and start to introduce, for example, vegetation into tall buildings, in the roof, in the facade, in the interior spaces, where greenery, the natural element, becomes a larger part of the expression of the building. You know, here in Chicago, it's been used in green roofs to spectacular effect in terms of helping thermally insulate the building, reduce the heat island effect, create recreational space. We can use it for all those things and also to create the tall buildings of the future, which are a reflection of the age in which we now exist. And that's an age which has got to seriously tackle the problems of climate change.
Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
You're quite welcome. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Anthony Wood is the executive director of the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. We caught him just after his presentation at the Chicago Humanities Festival, and his interview was engineered by me. Coming up after this short break, we'll speak with David Dixon. He'll tell us about the urban park structure he's designed for Miami and New Orleans and how great parks create great community. You're listening to Smart City. Hello to our podcast listeners. I just had a quick note about some of the conversations that are happening on our social networking site, My City. Our listeners are continuing to talk about the topics we bring up on the show, from rent control to mass transit, from your favorite online urbanism tools to why you choose to live in the city in the first place. My City is a place where people who love cities can meet and chat and get great new ideas. Please join us. Send an email to our producer, Scotty Iseri, at scotty@smartcityradio.com. He'll get you all set up. And now, back to the show. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Plan Edison's assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Senator Barack Obama has been elected the next president of the United States. Now, as Obama prepares to take the helm, the hopes and promises of the long campaign must harden into reality. But what impact will an Obama presidency have on urban policy? A big one, according to some experts. Washington Post columnist Neil Pierce thinks that Obama's regional focus will lead to a federal government that is very active in city issues. But he'll likely take an approach that differs from the classic Democratic policy. In particular, Pierce points to Obama's promise to invest $200 million in annual grants to bolster, quote, innovation clusters, areas of cutting-edge thinking and technology and applied science. Pierce concludes that there are, of course, many challenges ahead for an Obama presidency, but he says, quote, Metro America's chances will surely be brighter. But Stephen Malanga, senior editor for City Journal, thinks Obama's urban policies are outdated maneuvers that could have a detrimental effect on cities. He specifically calls out Obama's support for the Community Development Block Grant Program. According to Malanga, these block grants are, quote, perhaps the most visible example of the failure of federal urban aid. Obama's reliance on them, he says, will only continue that record of failure. But some of the more concrete impacts Obama's presidency could have on the country are in the realms of infrastructure and energy. Much of the rhetoric on energy so far is focused on the obvious: reducing reliance on foreign oil, investing in renewable energy sources, cutting excess use, and expanding domestic production of, quote, clean energy. But as the New York Times reported in August, Obama has called for an investment of $150 billion in renewable energy production, an investment towards a goal of doubling the nation's renewable energy sources to 10% of total needs. This is a goal he hopes to achieve by the end of his first term. And in an allusion to the large-scale public works projects of the New Deal era, Obama has highlighted infrastructure as a major concern for the United States. In a recent interview on MSNBC, he said that one of the most important infrastructure projects the country needs is an entirely new electricity grid system that allows for more efficient transmission of energy derived from renewable sources. If realized, this could translate to an injection of more than 5 million jobs into the U.S. economy. In the end, however, the work of urban planning, zoning, and development lies in the hands of local government, so it won't be directly affected by a new president in the day-to-day world. But if this evidence and all the election season discourse is to be believed, an Obama presidency could be one more closely focused on the needs and the importance of urban areas than presidencies of recent past. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. David Dixon is the principal of planning and urban design with Goody Clancy & Associates. Goody Clancy is a design firm out of Boston, and David has been responsible for some of its most interesting work. He's created master plans and public spaces for Miami's parks and the University Village in Karachi, Pakistan. David, you completed a vision for Miami's 21st century parks and public spaces. Describe that vision.
It was about bringing parks that really created community in a very diverse city to every neighborhood. And this wasn't a matter so much of adding new parks. That's extraordinarily expensive in this day and age, even with reduced real estate prices. It was a matter of bringing the kinds of programming to the parks the city already had to make them really relevant to the 21st century communities that lived around them. Miami is as diverse as a city can get, as America can get, and actually as America is getting. And what is fascinating is to understand how different cultures want to and frankly need to use public spaces, particularly parks, in different ways, and the really wonderful ways in which these parks can be adapted so communities really can use them, are really drawn together to use them.
Give me an idea of what the programming might look like in a Miami park.
Well, you know, it's very interesting, and I'll be kind of blunt and direct. There are large African-American neighborhoods in Miami where the ability to have football leagues operating, frankly, late into the night is kind of a make or break for the lives of many of the families that live in those neighborhoods. We're having community meeting rooms that can bring people together who often aren't in a position to meet in their own homes is hugely important to nurture the kind of civic life of these neighborhoods. There are other neighborhoods where the population has been changing fairly rapidly, but we're a real point of entry. For example, Little Haiti or Little Havana are no longer lived in by Haitians or Cubans, but they have tremendous cultural and civic importance for those communities. And to recognize that with public spaces that, in effect, are monuments, memorialize the passing through, the into America, through these neighborhoods of these cultures, in effect, is hugely important. Having a little Haitian cultural center in Little Haiti means an immense amount to the Haitian community, even though most of them don't live there anymore, and enriches all of Miami.
Is it fair, though, to take a park in Little Haiti that, as you say, where Haitians no longer live or are not the predominant ethnic group that occupy the neighborhood, and devote that park to memorializing Haitians?
I would say it wouldn't be fair if there were two groups in America, Haitians and everybody else. But there are many groups, and I think it's fair to tell all of our stories. And I think we all not only deserve that, but we all really enjoy learning each other's stories. So what really intrigued me is a Haitian cultural center was not something that the current residents of Little Haiti, who are actually fairly diverse, opposed at all. They thought it was kind of cool to have a cultural center in the midst of their neighborhood. But that's because they were equally aware that lots of their own needs in terms of sports and recreation and other things that they very much wanted were also being attended to.
Let me ask you something. You're talking primarily about programming rather than, as you say, design and building of new parks. What are the newest ideas in parks and public spaces? If you swept around the world, David, what would you see that looks different than what we know about parks and public spaces?
It is places that create a sense of community in neighborhoods and in cities that are far more diverse than they've ever been. And this is true in much of the world. And I'll sort of reinforce this by saying two friends and I just finished a book in urban design. And one aspect of that book looked at projects that had won AIA Regional and Urban Design Honor Awards over the last 11 years. And I wrote the chapter on public spaces. And I realized when I was done, certainly didn't start out this way, that not a single one of these projects was notable or had been honored because it represented a wonderful formal design. All of them have been noteworthy because of the cool and wonderful things that drew different kinds of people to enjoy them and use them. In effect, these were parks and public spaces that were filling the void that we may never have associated parks with, but that churches and schools and other places where we all shared as communities once played in our lives. And this is true particularly in America, but also Europe and other parts of the world. Well, many parts of the world already were melting pots. We're doing some work just outside of Karachi. And Karachi is a city that grew from sort of nothing to 18 million extraordinarily rapidly. People refer to it as little Pakistan. Every ethnic, cultural, religious, whatever group is represented there. And it's a city where the single struggle is to find things that people actually can share in common, places that they want to be together at the same time doing the same things.
Is there something that you do with a park that signals that it's okay for people of different backgrounds, different ethnic groups, to come together in this particular space?
Yes, there are two things. And the first is obviously temporal, but boy, involving people in planning together for a park is hugely important because in the end, the community, when you leave it, desperately wants to know that they authored the plan for their park. Very few people want someone to come in and tell them what their park should be. They want to invent it for themselves. And secondly, it is a park, and again, programmed with activities that invite very different kinds of people. There are kids who are 14 who want to do nothing more than play football. There are communities where having a dance studio that they're mostly daughters, in some cases sons, can go to is hugely important because of the values they place. Checkers turns out in Miami to be an outdoor checkerboard with some shade and seats is an open invitation to a lot of people from Central and South America. Recognizing that there are people who like to hang around sort of by the sidewalk where their friends will walk by, and shade and places to sit that invite that are wonderful, and other people who come to a park because there is just the coolest play fountain that all different kinds of kids will be attracted to and come to, and they look forward to the fact that they're going to meet the parents of these kids who are very different from them.
You were talking about the programming and And one of the things that helps invite different people into parks is one, planning together for that park, and second, programming with activities for very different markets. But we've seen some pitched battles, brutal battles, about how to use parkland. If we use parkland for ball fields, then it eliminates other types of uses, right? Because you've used it for a ball field, you've used it for a soccer field. Do we have playgrounds or not in a particular park? Do we give parkland management over to private entities or not? Are there any good ways to settle these competing claims on parks?
Well, nothing in life works out ideally, but first of all, and this wasn't part of your question, but it's really important to state, there are two things. It is so much easier to lose parkland than to gain it today. There are so many non-park uses, in addition to a public school, a library, that appear to be hugely worthy candidates that can't afford to buy land. And so some cities, like Miami, have used parks. And that, over time, turns out to bring a terrible price. Secondly, I don't think there's a city in America today that can fund adequate programming, and this is actually getting to your question, for its parks without dedicated revenue sources that are strictly intended to support programming activities and maintenance. And I think that the pitched battles tend to come more readily, more quickly, in communities that view their parks as sort of a shrinking pie that they have to fight over, meaning they're really worried about funding and other issues, so that if a park is lost to a ball field, lost in quotes, the things they loved about that park can't be reproduced somewhere else, or possibly new land purchased. But secondly, I have to say that when people are given a chance to really look comprehensively at all of the park resources and to really think together about how many kids are there who really want to play football or baseball or soccer, and where can they play, and what role do school recreation fields have in looking at a citywide park and recreation and public space resources and things like that, that generally these fights can be resolved. And in fact, if they can't be resolved, then this is a city that really doesn't have enough parkland and public space. And that then becomes an issue of finding the dedicated revenues that will enable it to buy new land. And that's expensive.
But people are supporting, voters are supporting that these days. What? How do you account for that? I mean, it seems that people are opposed to taxes for most everything, except that people are taxing themselves for parkland.
Well, I think it's because people love the chance to be a community, to celebrate the fact they're a community. They also like to enjoy nature, and they like recreation, and they like to know their kids have a place to play. But I think deep down there is a hunger for places that bring people together, because we've lost so many of them as we've become a much more diverse society. You know, we don't all go to church suppers on Sunday because none of us belong to the same church, at least not within 50 miles of each other. And so places that really form the heart of a neighborhood, and a park can do that. It's about the only thing I can think of today that can, are really important to people.
Have you thought about, David, using parks for purposes other than recreation?
Yeah, actually, you just reminded me. We are right now working it's the Cambridge City Council and a neighborhood that are very concerned about 1.5 million square feet of new life science research. And one of the benefits that this life science research developer has offered is to create a park. What is really fascinating is all the other benefits to this neighborhood, to quality of life, that this park implies. Because once this park is there, then it is possible, for example, for this developer to fund, and this is a very high-value development, so it can happen in this case, to fund ongoing management and programming of this park. That means that there are all kinds of organizations in this neighborhood that could now have a place to hold events and invite the rest of the community to come in and be with them, to see what they do, to be enriched by their activities and their mission. It actually invites relocation of a community center that's in an old building that's falling apart. and which could thrive next to this park, in part because it could offer much more robust summer camps and daycare or childcare programs, but also it could use the park to hold festivals and other events that enrich the lives of everybody who lives in this neighborhood. And again, this is a very diverse neighborhood, racially, economically, and in every way. And this park would represent probably the first time that they have a place that they would all want to come to at the same time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Dixon of the design firm Goody Clancy in Boston. David leads the firm's planning and urban design division and is responsible for some very interesting work creating master plans for public spaces worldwide. You mentioned your work in Karachi earlier. You recently completed a plan for what's called University Village. You had two objectives, and I think they're both fascinating. One was to create a 21st century model of Muslim city building and to create a vital community of learning. First of all, what is it that you reference from the history of Muslim city building to inform your 21st century model?
Well, I should say, first of all, to pay appropriate deference to Muslim city building, that it, in fact, is a very rich and diverse tradition that embraces many approaches. But what is fascinating and was sort of a life lesson for me is to realize how much, and I'll use Western and Muslim as if they're two opposing schools of thought. In fact, it's a lot more complex. But you and I live in a society that when it thinks about creating a community, immediately thinks of systems, of streets, of networks of public space, of utilities, of transportation access. Traditionally, Muslim communities were conceived in a very different way, and it's a much richer tradition. They were conceived around a series of places that people thought were wonderful. And the tradition gets a little more complex than that. They also had to do with the role of women in that society and sort of being sequestered in wonderful courtyards and things like that that are part of that of a different tradition. But Muslim city building is much more cellular. It is adding one wonderful place to another, one courtyard, one souk, one sort of fascinating network of pathways that we think of as medieval, but in fact actually represent how you connect spaces when you worry less about the connection and more about the quality of each space to each other and gradually building up a community.
I love your description. Your second objective was to build a vital community of learning. Every community should want to be a community of learning. What are the design principles that underpin a community of learning?
Yeah, and I'm going to speak universally as if there were no difference between Pakistan and the U.S. for a minute, and that's not true. Well, let me take a step back. We're doing this work for the Aga Khan, who has a wonderful and really important mission in mind, which is to create a liberal arts university in a part of the world where this is not a learning tradition, and with a very conscious aim, or a series of them, one of which is to train a new generation of leadership, and a generation of leadership that grows up in a liberal arts tradition in which no single discipline owns knowledge. And in fact, the best ideas are acknowledged to grow from people of many disciplines working together in an ongoing and never-ending effort to sort of discover truth, to discover the right way. It therefore requires that we create a community that does everything possible to, I'm going to use a real 19 or 2000 whatever term, break down silos. Because even in a liberal arts university, people are very worried about pursuing their own careers, the writing they have to do, the relationships with their graduate students that are very time consuming. Even in a place where there's a conscious effort to cross disciplinary lines, to collaborate, the forces against it are very strong. And so it is hugely important to create places, and this gets back to the parks discussion we had, that invite people to informally and unexpectedly spend time together, discover shared truths they never imagined given their own individual understandings of aspects of these truths, to understand and discover aspirations in each other that they hadn't even imagined existed, let alone in the people they're talking to, so that they informally, as well as the formal efforts within the campus itself, really come to embrace each other and understand the value, even at a personal level, to learning from each other, to solving problems together. So the University Village, and it's not finished yet. We're working, I hope, on the final stages of the initial planning, is all about, first of all, this is an issue from all our lives, inviting people to get out of their cars, because once they get in their cars to go from point A to point B, the inability to have these unexpected, informal, unplanned, but sometimes earth-shattering interactions is lost. So Pakistan, particularly the Karachi area, is an area where mass auto ownership is so recent that people remember. It is not that long ago in their lives that they remember the pre-automobile era, and they know the difference between how often they run into each other and see each other and have chance meetings. So this will be a village where walkability is the first principle, and that means inviting destinations. It means a public transit system, so a rubber wheel shuttle system that is more convenient than driving. It means creating as many places that invite people to spend time together, because it's a great place to get something to eat or there's some shade and a fountain. It's about making sure that people inside the campus are drawn out by a wonderful, lively souk into the life of the village, so they don't just spend time on campus pursuing their own individual intellectual disciplines.
I love your description again. Okay, but you've designed University Village as part of something called Education City, and we're seeing a lot more of this from the Middle East, from China, where, you know, something is labeled with a big idea. Doesn't that run counter to the idea that we ought to be mixing uses?
Yes, it does. That said, we are talking about, well, frankly, we could talk about our part of the world, too, where it is so complicated to mix these uses into existing communities. And this campus and the surrounding campuses can be achieved so much faster by allocating a piece of land to do it that it's really the only alternative. A lot has been said about that we all learn lessons ahead of the rest of the world. And there is an awareness in the U.S. of the value of smart growth, of compact communities in terms of creating community, bringing different kinds of people together. And it is a very important lesson. And it's one the rest of the world probably in some ways was aware of before us, because most of the world lives in much more compact development, where rich and poor people live much closer together and interact more. Nevertheless, the complexities of cities like Karachi make it extraordinarily difficult to take advantage of those lessons they probably already knew. And hence Education City. And I'll comment, if you walk through the Medina of Fez or Tunis, the old historic community, you walk through a place where very rich and very poor people, where clients and the powerful people to whom these clients served all lived next to each other, on top of each other, without distinction. This is a society that in many ways was much more democratic than we probably give it credit for in terms of its willingness to mix very different kinds of people together. And one of the goals of it, of the University Village, is to reclaim that tradition, to bring different kinds of people again together. By moving Education City outside of Karachi, one of the dangers is that you do create places that are outside of the mix where the wealthy will move in a way very similar to what happened in the U.S. And I think one of the real missions in much of the world is to avoid the kind of economic fragmentation that we experienced.
When you think about great public spaces, great parks, pick three cities that you think someone looking for those great parks, great public spaces needs to visit.
Well, I would start with Chicago. I think Millennium Park, and it's interesting, Millennium Park is a park whose formal plan I don't think anybody can diagram, but is probably the most beloved new public space in America because its programming is so spirited and artful and lively and vibrant and diverse in its appeal. That said, San Francisco, Golden Gate Park is a chance to experience nature in a city unlike any city I know. It is just an extraordinary resource. You can walk from the city into the Redwoods, you know, in 10 minutes, and it's a remarkable gift. And I'm being very American here. Cincinnati I would go to for a different lesson. It has a beautiful park system, a series of wonderful empty and now dangerous parks because they made the decision to separate recreation from parks, in part to preserve the parks. And get back to the point you raised earlier. And what happened is all the activity left the parks. So they are sitting there as empty, beautiful, and often viewed as dangerous rather than amenities by the neighborhoods around them. Boston has a wonderful tradition of parks, which it came close to losing because they were so underfunded for many years, and which it has been actively reclaiming. And I think that's an important message. And they're parks that really link as an interconnected system, which means that actually millions of people in Boston, more than 2 million people a year, bike and jog around the along the Charles River Esplanade because it's a loop, it's a continuous system that they can really use. And, you know, there are actually many cities in America that have great park systems, most of them because they were lucky enough around the turn of the century during the, when the City Beautiful movement was so prominent to create these park systems. Miami is an example, a very brave example of a latter-day city attempting not to catch up, but in the 21st century way to create a great park system, and it's a lot tougher today.
It's been such an interesting discussion, David. Thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you. I love talking to you.
David Dixon is the principal at the design firm Goody Clancy in charge of planning and urban design. He joined us from the road in San Francisco, and his interview was engineered by Andy McDaniel. That's it for this week's show. If you want to know more about our guests and their work, point your browser to smartcityradio.com. You'll find there an archive of all of our shows. Sign up for our mailing list and subscribe to our podcast so you can take Smart City with you wherever you go. If you've got a question or a comment, email us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He couldn't think of anything funny this week, and neither could I. I'm Carol Coletta.